Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said to Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an anarchist independent literary press that publishes socially engaged literature. With me today are the two other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. Today we are going to discuss two novels by the author Gore Vidal, Myra Breckinridge, and its sequel, Myron. Before we do, if you want to go to our website, kaidraconis.org, that's kaidraconis.org, to check out the books that we've published and that we're going to publish, that would be cool. You can order a book for free. All of our books are free to readers as a statement against commodification. However, if you would like to support the press, you can donate to us using our donate page. Now, My thought was that Myra Breckinridge was a fantastic novel that was really interesting and funny, and that its sequel, Myron, was probably really bad, and
was bad, or like you didn't like it.
It's okay. But it's ethically problematic, and
aren't both of them are ethically problematic, right?
I think Myra is less ethically problematic, because at least in Myra, even if Myra is portrayed as kind of a weird sociopath, you know, she's at least a human character. You know, she has complexity. But go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's... So, I guess, should we give a little bit of background for the books, about the books?
Sure, yeah.
So, Myra Breckinridge was published by Gore Vidal in 1968. It's about a woman named Myra Breckinridge who has a... she comes to a school for the performing arts in Los Angeles, that's run by her deceased husband's uncle, and basically comes to it with the intention of taking it over, and has kind of a goal of, in the course of the novel, makes the argument that essentially, and you guys can correct me if I'm framing this wrong, but essentially makes the argument that conventional gender roles and conventional masculine feminine behavior are leading to overpopulation, which in turn is leading to great human misery and suffering and war, and will continue to do so in the future, and that the best thing for the future of the human race is to try to destroy and overturn conventional masculine and feminine roles, and kind of sets out on a personal campaign to do that by there's a couple that she fixes on, Rusty and Marianne, and Rusty is sort of this very, very conventional macho early 20s man, and she sexually abuses and assaults him with a dildo in this really kind of interesting sort of quasi S&M scene that I think might be one of the ethically problematic things that you were talking about, Chris. Maybe we'll get to that, I'm sure. And then begins a lesbian relationship with Marianne. And at the end of the novel, I don't think it's a big surprise, but at the end of the novel, it's revealed that Myra is actually... That Myra was born as Myron Breckinridge, who supposedly is the dead husband. That she is, in fact, in some sense, the same person, but is the term transsexual is used in the novel. Probably today you would use the term transgender. And so that in some sense they're at least in a physical sense the same person. And at the end of the novel, Myra is hit by a car, and in the course of being treated for that injury, basically stops having hormonal treatment, and without the hormonal treatment, the Myron persona ends up reasserting itself. And then the sequel to that, Myra, the sequel to that, Myron, takes place in, it's a little hard to describe, but basically it takes place in a movie that's being filmed in, is it 1952?
48.
1948. So it takes place in a movie that's being filmed in 1948, except that Myra and Myron have kind of been like sucked into a television and are in 1948, but they're also in a giant television. And sometimes they're like watching the movie and sometimes they're in it. And it's all the parameters of the, if this universe are very hazily described. And Myra and Myron sort of fight for control, and at the end of the novel, basically Myra uses 1948 as a, she uses her knowledge of the future and her canniness to promote the idea of androgyny in the culture, and causes an alternate timeline to be established in which the president is androgynous, and androgyny, and androgyny is kind of the main, is held up as an ideal instead of conventional gender. And I picked these books as much as anything just because they're, Myra Breckinridge, actually, it's hard to imagine now, but it was very successful when it came out in 1968. And there was even a film adaptation, which is, I haven't seen it because it's quite hard to find now, but by my understanding, it was actually quite faithful to the events in the novel, some of which are, even today, would be kind of transgressive to have in a major studio film, and yet it seems kind of forgotten now, right? I became familiar with this novel. There's a documentary about the debates that Gore Vidal had with William F. Buckley in the late 60s, early 70s. I watched a documentary about those debates which mentioned Myra Breckinridge in passing. And it was the first time I'd ever heard of it. You know, when I was going to grad school, I never heard it mentioned. I've never seen any other reference to it. I happened to come upon it in a bookstore and bought it. And so I guess the fundamental question that I had is this an overlooked classic? Or is this something that maybe is not a good fit for kind of contemporary mores and perspectives, and maybe kind of deserves to be in the dustbin of history, I suppose. So that's just a background. And Patrick, you were talking about why Myron, the sequel, is the question we came right out of the gate with is, if we all take it as a given that Myron is the inferior of the two books by a pretty fair amount, why is that? Is that an ethical matter? Is that an aesthetic matter?
Well, from my perspective, it's not as good for a couple reasons. And and actually, I said it's ethically problematic, and which I think it is, but the main thing that I think I had a problem with is, in Myra, whenever Myra thinks of Myron, she thinks of him sympathetically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she has evolved out in her identity has widened and, you know, transformed in some ways. But Myron is still kind of a core piece of her, I would say. Like, a lot of Myron's ideas about population and whatnot are still Myra's ideas.
Yeah.
But in Myron, like, somehow that interesting relationship where she is sympathetic to him but evolved away from him is replaced just kind of like by a pretty lame, you know, kind of multiple personality gag, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and like one in which Myron has gone from being an interesting character and a layered character into this very, very one-dimensional parody of sort of a bland middle-class silent majority Nixon voter type.
Right. And you know, so Myron's character changes a lot, and I'm not quite sure why. You know, when you, you know, I don't see why there would be this huge break so that she actually thinks she's two different people. You know, that's mm-hmm. you know, one, the evidence for multiple personality disorder is, does it even really exist? I don't know. And two, it's a cliche. And mm-hmm. three, you know, like you said, Hans, he's very different. You know, why is Myron, who is a in the first novel attracted to men, and you know, who's a layered, interesting character, why does he just become this Nixon voter, like you said?
Yeah, but
Hans?
I'd say, do we know that about Myron in the first novel? I mean, we get Myra's testimony about Myron, which is sympathetic, but I agree. I would say that like Myron is just not as serious of a novel. And I have a couple of reasons for feeling that way. And I think Myra is also just a much far more interesting character in the first novel for reasons too. But talking about Myron specifically, I don't know that I don't know that I would say I felt Myron was explicitly different between the two novels, because the only real time we spend with Myron is at the very, very end. Other than that, what you're talking about is what Myra says about Myron.
Yeah, but I don't see why we're supposed to doubt her reflections of an identity that really is contiguous with her own.
No, it's not contiguous with the Myron at the end of the first novel, who's a Christian Science faithful, who's like, you know, kind of a suddenly a very different, you know, who's a married man with a woman.
Right.
I didn't really feel that
happened at the end of Myra.
Yeah.
I must have missed something then.
I'm flipping right now. I'm trying to find the end of Myra just to kind of try to get a sense of who Myron is at that time. So, let's see. So the only time that Myron really speaks is just in the last couple pages of Myra Breckinridge. And at the beginning of that section, Myron refers to, the first thing that he says is, "I have spent all morning reading this notebook," meaning the text of the novel Myra Breckinridge, "and I can hardly believe that I was ever the person who wrote those demented pages." So who knows who Myron was before he became Myra, right? But I don't know that there's any way to definitively pin that down, other than maybe, you know, what his uncle says about him, which does seem to, you don't get much from his uncle, I don't think. But it does seem like the Myron that's portrayed at the very end of Myra Breckinridge is basically in line with the Myron of the second novel, albeit without so many of the kind of ham-handed parodies of the middle-class Nixon voter. But, I mean, I think ultimately, I think we might be less concerned with the continuity or discontinuity if Myron were just a better character, right?
Sure.
I mean, I think that we might be less inclined to question his authenticity as a character within the world of the novel if he just felt more like a full character and less like Gore Vidal just kind of prodding middle America.
Right.
I think too, I don't know. It's funny. It's weird to say now, but when I first read these novels, I actually remembered liking Myron more of the two, which is why I suggested reading them as a package deal. And I think the thing that impressed me then, I think by the time I read Myra Breckinridge, I knew enough about what it was about and what happened in it that some of the surprise was blunted, right? I knew, you know, the scene where she sexually assaults Rusty is actually a clip from the movie version of that is shown in the Gore Vidal documentary. So there was a lack of surprise that I had going into Myra Breckinridge that might have blunted how much I would have enjoyed it the first time through. Whereas Myron, if nothing else, it's so weird in the plot and the setup, and it's creative in a certain way, right? Even if what it does with that creativity now on a second read seems kind of dumb. At the time, I think I was more sympathetic to Myron because it seemed like a more experimental novel. It seemed like, in some ways, like a more creative as a piece of fiction. I would not at all stand by that opinion now, though. And I think that, I mean, what bothered me, I think, well, there were a lot of things that bothered me about, I enjoyed reading Myron, but I enjoyed it in the way that one enjoys reading something that one acknowledges is not necessarily good per se, right? I certainly wasn't bored, but there's just something very self-indulgent about, it's so interested in old Hollywood, right? I mean, Myra as a character is always very interested in old Hollywood, and she's very devoted to the aesthetic of old Hollywood, and she knows film trivia. She knows old Hollywood film trivia intimately and can quote it at great length. But in Myra Breckinridge, that's just kind of a character trait. Whereas in Myron, it feels like a really, like the primary aesthetic motivation of writing it was just to kind of luxuriate in all this sort of old Hollywood nerdiness, right? And that, even if I were more into that sort of thing, it just gives it kind of an insularity that is not really ideal. Mm-hmm. So, I guess that kind of, are there other thoughts that we have about the superiority of Myra Breckinridge to Myron?
I would say,
or
that
Chris,
for me,
Chris, are you? I mean, you're taking a breath. Like maybe you want to defend Myron.
Oh no, I don't. I don't want to defend Myron. I enjoyed it, like you said. It's really like fun, mm-hmm. but and it's interesting. I read Myra. I read text for Myra, and I listened to the audiobook version of Myron. So. They kind of that kind of accentuates sort of like what felt to me like the things that I really liked in Myra that sort of like felt like subtext. For instance, like the there are things that kind of like I feel like thread through Myra Breckinridge that without Myron feel like Myra, her motivations, you described her motivations at the beginning, Hans, as mm-hmm. really sort of like ideologically defined. And I think they are ideologically defined, but reading Myra Breckinridge, I kind of came away with the impression that they were not ideologically motivated. They were rather motivated kind of by trauma. And I wondered maybe if that's like, what Patrick was getting to a little bit, where kind of Myron, the way that Myra talks about Myron, it feels, and the way that she reacts to men, the way that she sort of plans to emasculate Rusty, feel as though it doesn't necessarily line up with I'm trying to think of a better example. I had one, but it fled me. I felt as though, I guess, like, even though she was saying she wanted to do these things for ideological reasons, the way she talked about Myron's really, really troubled sexual relationships with men, and her own sometimes her longer rants and her sort of introspection, I felt sort of gave room to interpret her motivations as not actually like ideological, and more that she was actually getting revenge.
Mm-hmm.
I think she even mentions that she's kind of getting back at Rusty, or Rusty's sort of an avatar for all the men that basically gave it to Myron from behind.
Sodomized.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And that, I think, allowed for that really amazing, like, incredible, like just amazing chapter in which Rusty is sexually abused by Myra. It's incredible. It gave room for that to sort of breathe in multiple directions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also Myra Breckinridge, the book, like in that book, she actually fails to change Rusty.
Exactly.
In the way that she intends. Whereas in Myron, her plan is even just completely more nuts, to basically create a culture of androgyny starting and carried by mid-century, you know, film. And she somehow succeeds in that. And it feels as though the first book takes place in a kind of reality that's mediated through maybe a troubled mind. And the second book doesn't feel like it takes place in any reality at all. That was my feeling kind of between the two of them.
That's very well put. Yeah. And mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, and I think too, I'm really glad that you brought up the point that she fails, right? In Myra Breckinridge, she violently emasculates Rusty with the stated goal of making him essentially less of a stereotypical heterosexual male. And his response to that is to then essentially become much more macho, much more aggressive, much more sexually violent. Early in the novel,
become a woman hater.
Yeah, to become a woman hater and to become a, you know, someone who there's a character, Letitia Van Allen, who's an agent who actually was played by Mae West in the film version. Oddly enough, she came out of retirement to do it, and Rusty is sleeping with Letitia Van Allen, and Letitia says, you know, it's great. He beats me up now, essentially. And his girlfriend, Marianne, says, oh, you know, when he was with me before he met Myra, he was very gentle. He was very considerate. He was actually much less stereotypically macho and violent in bed than a lot of men were, you know. So it seems like what Myra does this thing. I think your point, Chris, is maybe a good one, that Myra has this gut level urge to do this thing. And she then kind of comes up with this ideological apparatus to justify it, right? But then when it completely fails to achieve the thing that she says it's intending to do, she doesn't really seem that bothered by it, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, that at the very end of the novel, it turns out that Rusty actually was gay. But that, if anything, presumably what Myra did to him, rather than making him come to terms with that in an effective way, made him spend a certain period of time as a violent misogynist before eventually, ultimately, coming to terms with the fact that he was gay all along. I don't know the fact that he ends up being gay at the very end. I don't know how much that complicates the simple reading. I mean, the simple reading, not the simple reading necessarily, but it feels like the reading we've kind of arrived at is that Myra is assaulting him as a way of exacting some kind of revenge for her own trauma, which then perpetuates the same kind of cycle, right? I don't know how much it complicates that if Rusty is gay, comes out as gay at the end. I don't think that it does, but it doesn't fit super cleanly as a detail either.
Well, it at least to the it has like an anti-parallelism with Myron's reemergence at the end of the novel. If that makes any sense, like, you know, so the way Myra remembers Myron as a kind of tormented gay man, but a person at least who knows that he's gay and knows that he, at least this is the way Myra remembers him, right? I'm not saying that that's the way he is, but Myra remembers Myron sympathetically as a gay man who suffered some abuse at the hands of the men that he ended up becoming lovers with. And then when we actually see Myron in the flesh for the first time, it's like he's so distanced from that he pushes away from that identity. So maybe there's some kind of complication in that the roles of Myra and Rusty appear reversed, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
I had a question about the endings of these books, both of the books. So the endings kind of come out of nowhere. Are they lazy?
Well, I think the ending of Myron has to come out of nowhere because it's so deeply, deeply implausible that probing the mechanism by which it occurs or portraying the mechanism by which it occurs is probably a self-defeating enterprise. I mean, I think all of Myron is kind of lazy and self-indulgent. I don't think that the ending is necessarily exceptionally so beyond...
It's not lazy relative to the rest of the book.
It's not lazy relative to... I mean, Myron really just seems like Gore Vidal having a good time kind of screwing around with old film trivia, you know?
Except for the Steve scene. When Myron comes to and Steve is like... secured to the bed,
mm-hmm.
and he's just been shaved. That's mm-hmm. that was the high point of Myron for me.
And I really like too the so there's kind of a there's one of the devices that Myron uses is that like one of the devices that the novel Myron uses is that when the actors in this film, Sirens of Babylon, when it's a TV commercial, they all just kind of freeze and kind of they're frozen there. And they're like not aware during that time. So the way that she contacts this character, Steve, is by writing a message on the back of a fortune cookie fortune and slipping it under his foreskin. So... when he comes back into consciousness, he just finds this note under his foreskin.
And I don't know how you got it down there.
And I did find that. I love that. That's hilarious. I mean, and it's the kind of great little detail that it doesn't redeem something like this, but it suggests the fun that's being had in the course of writing it. And it makes it worth reading, even if, in a lot of ways, it's not really a great book.
So what about the first book? The ending, is it lazy?
Well, it does kind of come out of nowhere. I mean, I guess, did you guys read The Driver as being, did you read it as the driver who hit Myra? Is that an accident or is that... Buck Loner or
she
Rusty?
She guesses that it's her uncle, right?
Or Rusty.
Yeah.
Right?
So I mean, so if you buy that as being I mean, that she's driven Buck or Rusty to kind of this extreme of desperation and they're acting out violently. I guess it fits kind of within the arc of the novel. It fits within the arc of the story.
I mean, I definitely don't like what I see as a huge character change right at the end with Myron. I don't think that works that well.
Hmm.
But yeah,
I don't
it's
know.
Probably yeah. lazy. It's probably super lazy.
Yeah, the thing is, though, I mean, if you think about what would classically be considered a less lazy ending, right? I mean, a less lazy ending by conventional standards would be that Myra goes, oh, gosh, when I sexually assaulted Rusty, it actually did the opposite of what it was supposed to do, and maybe my motivations for that weren't what I thought, and maybe I should get therapy, or something like that, right? Where a less conventional, well, that's not a good example maybe, but a less conventionally lazy ending would be Myra changes somehow and evolves as a character and comes out on the other end with a more textured understanding of herself and behaves more productively. And that would be kind of, I don't know, she's just so, like her total stubbornness, right? Her total stubbornness, her total commitment to being this destructive entity are part of what make her admirable and fun. So I don't know that it would be, I don't know that, I'm not sure how else you could end it without compromising that, the totality of that character. Sorry, well, maybe, what were you going to say, Chris?
I was going to say, I'm with Patrick, I think. I think there's something about the Myron at the end of Myra Breckenridge that makes it feel as though identity is, like the idea, I guess like the idea of identity being mercurial is one thing, but the way in which we get this grounding in an idea of Myron that doesn't seem consistent in a way, or the only place that I have to go, like just sort of thinking through Myron at the end in relationship to how Myra remembers Myron, is that there's something interesting in how he has repressed or, you know, like done something to sort of deviate from that, or there's something interesting in how Myra sort of infantilizes this alternate personality while she's in charge. But I don't, the way that the ending with that feels, I'll say, like, I kind of found the ending lazy is maybe the wrong way of putting it. It's just that it felt like it ended on a kind of a joke that I did feel sort of undermined, like Myra feels herself becoming a god, you know, with Marianne sort of like closing the sexual loop, like basically transcending gender and consuming the, you know, both poles of a sexual unit, and in a really terrifying psychotic way.
Right, right. She's fucked up, but
she's terrible.
Yeah,
yeah.
She's super interesting that way, though.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Like Han said, then, she's horrible, but she's admirable.
Yeah. And then you kind of jump to Myron, and it's a joke.
Yeah, it's just like I can't believe I was demented.
It's sort of like a waking, it's like a, you know, like it's the dream. Well, I guess it was all a dream.
Yeah, yeah. It's very much like that. Very much like
and
that.
It, and it does undermine ending. That character. It does undermine that character somewhat that she can, that for as utterly strong and intense as she is throughout the novel, that she kind of disappears when you stop the hormone treatments and cut off the breast implants, you know?
Right.
It's odd that she's so vulnerable in that regard.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess, so the question that I had in mind when I brought this in, right, was like, you know, if you're teaching, like if you were a literature professor at a university now and you were teaching a class on gender representation in literature, is this something that you assign and you say, this is a really interesting work? Or is this something that you say, okay, well, this is problematic for XYZ reasons. People aren't going to get behind this. This is maybe an artifact that maybe there are other things that deserve more attention than this particular artifact, right? And from a certain standpoint, if you were to take a negative line on this book, I mean, you have this work that essentially portrays a trans woman as a violent sociopath and to some extent...
And sexual predator.
A violent sociopath and a sexual predator, right? And the ending of the book does a lot to undermine defenses that you might have against that critique, right? Because at the very ending of the book, the persona of Myra, it's almost like she was some sort of bizarre demon that was exorcised by this car accident, you know, which...
That's definitely... That I just wanted to say that kind of hits the nail on the head. That's what I find problematic about Myron so much.
Yeah. Right. It sets up, like, that ending for Myra Breckinridge sets up a lot of what's problematic then about Myron. And I think that, I mean, the best defense that you can really make of Myra Breckinridge is, for one thing, that nobody else comes out any better, right? That none of the, that the worldview offered by the straight hetero, by the cis hetero characters, their worldview, their way of being is portrayed with no sympathy at all, right? And fundamentally... Even if Myra's actions are sometimes deplorable, you sense that she's coming from a perspective that the novel is still sympathetic to, and she's just so well done.
Yeah.
But then the way that she's dispatched at the end of the novel does probably undermine some of those defenses.
Well, and I'll say, kind of jumping to the end of Myron, I got the impression, and I actually kind of appreciated maybe this about the end of Myron, that it seems as though even though she succeeded in advancing her, like, sort of advancing androgyny, what is Myron's friend call himself? Sex stud male.
Republican President Stephanie Dude, the fun-loving Amazon.
So, yeah, that's perfect. It doesn't actually change anything. It changes a lot, but it doesn't solve the nationalistic, jingoism or the kind of like. It doesn't seem at the end, or it didn't seem to me. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong. You know, as Myron is reminding himself, like, oh, I must have just imagined that my friend had a kid, and good thing nothing changed. I'm still in the best country, you know, in the world, and
he's still a boring Philistine and a square.
Yeah, and it sounds like the country is probably still full of boring Philistines in a way that is just like now maybe a third of those boring Philistines are neutered males. It's not actually neutered former, you know, however they identify at this point. But it's like, I kind of appreciated that about that. Whereas, I felt like Myra was sort of progressing to a point where she was actually wondering about her own motivations, I think, and thinking about herself with Marianne and at a point of crisis that is fascinating. And Marianne, to go back to your earlier question, I would definitely teach this because I think it's just I would definitely teach Myra Breckinridge because there's so much to talk about, but But Marianne is like this really troubling character in terms of like female agency and, you know, like it doesn't, she's never given like anything like her own breathing space to be, to act at all like with any form of autonomy. And it's sort of worsened somehow, somehow made worse by the fact that like as Myron replaces Myra, she just becomes Myron's partner. Yeah. I don't know. There was something very, yeah, very that was, odd about it.
That was mega like strange. Like, you know, as far as I could see at the end of the novel, Marianne know that Myra was once Myron?
Yes, I think so.
Does she? Think so. Yeah, yeah.
But she definitely.
Let me see if I can confirm that.
She definitely does not know, right? That.
I mean, she knows in Myron. In Myron, I think that she knows that in Myra Breckenridge.
Right, in Myron, she does, but in Myra. So, you know,
she
that
would
whole,
only know after the car accident.
Right. So that whole conversation between them is skipped. Right. Mm-hmm. Where Myron has to be like, yeah, when you knew me as Myra, it's because, you know, I used to be this. I used to be Myron. You know, I became a woman. You know, that doesn't seem like she'd just be, yeah, sure. Just get one of those, you know, have a cosmetic surgeon make you a dick and let's get married.
This is what I mean. Know? This is all one sentence, and this is maybe like, this is like the sentence that we're talking about, kind of the last 5 minutes of our conversation. This is the last chapter. Although I nearly lost my mind and tried to kill myself when I learned that my breasts had been removed. Dr. Mengers had been forced to take this step because my life was endangered by the silicone, which, as a result of the accident, threatened to enter the bloodstream. I now realize it was the best thing that ever happened to me, if only because once Marianne realized that I was really Myron Breckenridge, her attitude toward me completely changed, or changed completely. So, like, it's just like there's so much in that one sentence.
Right.
and I, it's like I admire Vidal for, like, because like that is like exactly the sort of sentence that would just get you on the chopping or get you harangued in like a creative writing workshop class or something like that. Like, you know, you get like just like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
But so I kind of admire him for doing it. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't know. It's sort of, I don't know. Disappointing.
Yeah. I think it's a little disappointing. Not Myron the novel, Myra the novel. Just these last few pages don't live up to the rest of the novel, which is really good, I think.
That chapter where Rusty is sodomized is amazing.
It's horrifying.
It's incredible. It's absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, it's super horrifying, and she just like narrates it clinically, like this is what I did. Yeah. Well, not even clinically. It's more like, yeah, this is what I did to further my ideology. Yeah.
Right.
I'm the woman triumphant. It's like, fuck.
Yeah. It's truly horrifying in a way that I don't know if I've quite had this sense of dread ever since reading anything quite like this. So thank you, Hans.
It's interesting that it's going to take me a minute to figure out the best angle to come at this point from. So I hope it doesn't seem rambling, but when I was remembering these two novels, I was talking to my wife about Myra Breckenridge versus Myron. And I said something in passing like, well, you know, in some ways, Myron is, it's an easier novel to approach. If nothing else, there's not a rape in the middle of it. And then when I was rereading Myron, oh, she does actually rape a guy. But it just...
Yeah, Steve.
Yeah, she rapes Steve. But it's not... there's a power that it has in Myra Breckinridge, the way that the scene is developed, for all the reasons that you guys have talked about, that is kind of the center of gravity of the novel, right?
Right.
And in Myron, it's tossed off so casually as a joke, and that's very symptomatic, I think, of the gap between the two works.
Right.
I remember there
it
was...
Is. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
But there, well, and this is... I don't know if there's a way that I can make this point without... It's a very difficult point to make with the right kind of texture to it, right? But, like, when I first read Myra Breckinridge, it was right around the time that Milo Yiannopoulos was falling from grace, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, it's unfortunate, maybe... It's great in some ways, but unfortunate in other ways, that, like, this novel comes from a time when progressive politics, leftist politics, could be advanced artistically in a way that has this incredible sense of danger and transgression and thrill, right? This is a very, very leftist progressive novel, and there's just something scary about it. That mm-hmm. that kind of lasts even to this day. And it has an energy that comes from that that is fantastic, right? And I read this in 2016 when all that danger, all that transgressive energy was all concentrated on the right. And it made me, even though ultimately it's probably good that at least where I live, all these kind of progressive values have become this sort of mainstream bourgeois thing, there was some part of me that missed a little bit having the transgressive energy of somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos concentrated on the left instead of the right. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
If I wish Myra Breckinridge had a podcast.
Oh, man.
It would be amazing.
It'd be like the inversion of Howard Stern, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Ann Coulter of the left. I don't think Ann Coulter has a podcast, but.
Oh, she's so disgusting. Yeah. I can't handle her.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, Hans, for my part, I would not teach this in a lit class specifically devoted to transgender work.
It'd be fascinating to try to approach it in a college lit class, but you'd have to find a frame for it where it didn't seem like you were endorsing it, but also where you had to, you know, there's kind of a, you'd have to find a frame for it where you didn't want to seem like you were endorsing it totally, but also where you weren't just saying, okay, let's just all pile on the obvious criticisms that we can make of this from the standpoint of 2020 and the values of 2020, right?
Right. So, about our next chat, what, Hans, I have an idea, I have my pick, but I was also thinking that you were like, well, I wanted to pick another novel on this same topic, and I think maybe it's probably better that we do your novel next, and then
thinking it'd be better to, like, give the ideas some time to breathe and come back to them with a little hindsight.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I mean, I guess for listeners it would maybe be easier to track the series, but I think I'll just say, like, the next thing I wanted to look at was The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks. So that's going to be in 6 weeks or so when it comes back around to my pick. The Wasp Factory will be part two in the trilogy.
And okay, so you would prefer to wait then?
Yeah, I mean, I actually wanted to do three. I mean, four if you count Myra and Myron as two. So I don't want to, like, have three picks in a row and then just not pick anything for the whole rest of the year. So, yeah, I'm going to cede the floor. Yeah.
Okay. So let's do, for my pick, let's do Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Oh, I love it.
You've read it?
Oh God, it's great.
Oh, is it? Cool. Cool. That's awesome. I've never read it, but, you know, it's been on my list. I think it would be super sweet to talk about. And I was thinking that maybe we could also do a little homework, a little literary critical homework, look up an article or two just to add texture, because it's like a classic novel that, you know, has been talked about numerous times. So I feel like inserting ourselves into the dialogue would be beneficial, if that makes sense. So I'm going to say, let's each of us read the novel and each of us find one piece of literary criticism about the novel. And whether or not we actually bring up the literary criticism specifically, you know, that can be worked out. Does that sound cool?
Sounds good to me.
All right, cool.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, listeners, thank you for hearing our podcast on Gore Vidal's two novels, Myra Breckinridge and Myron, which are interesting, if maybe problematic in some ways. Again, check out our website, kaidrakonis.org. We are going to publish our first publication of 2020 in the latter half of June, and that will be a novella called The Sodomites, which is about kind of an anarchist collective trying to deal with apartheid in Israel, so and some other stuff. So it's pretty sweet. Check out our website to learn more about it, and maybe if you want to email me now and say, hey, give me a copy as soon as it comes out, that'd be awesome. And to you two gentlemen, thanks for talking. It's always a pleasure. Peace out, everyone.